Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Beth Voorhees, sitting in for Cecilia Mason. A program in Appalachia is assisting child care providers to save money for retirement.
Look how many people in the stores in our area, how many clerks are at those cash registers that are in their 80s. They're not able to be at home, and they look awfully tired.
Reporter Glennis Ford reminds us of a fading Appalachian tradition that bakers in West Virginia are working to preserve.
It's a very difficult bread to make. Primarily the main difference between salt rising bread and sourdough, which is wild yeast, salt rising bread is primarily wild bacteria that you're culturing with heat.
And in Pennsylvania, seed sharing is making gardening a little more affordable.
Last year we got purple cherry tomato seeds here. They were really good. They were some of the best cherry tomatoes I've ever had.
These are among the stories inside Appalachia this week. You're inside Appalachia. I'm Beth Voorhees, sitting in for Cecilia Mason. A new report warns that Americans, on the whole, have saved alarmingly little for retirement. In fact, at the bottom end of the pay scale, it finds more than three-quarters are at risk of running out of money. With low wages and few, if any, benefits, many say they can barely get by, let alone save for the future. A small program in Appalachia is working to change this for one group of workers, child care providers. NPR's Jennifer Ludden has the story.
Anita Wallace loves running a daycare at her home in rural Athens County, Ohio. The schedule's far more family-friendly than when she logged 60 hours a week as a manager at Walmart, and she adores the children.
There's a giggle.
The pay is about $27,000 a year, but Wallace and her husband still have three of their own kids to raise.
They're very expensive.
And as an in-home child care provider, Wallace is self-employed. No company 401k. She gets lots of tax deductions, and she's grateful, but it means she's only paying Social Security on a measly $5,000 of income, so will have only that to draw from in retirement. She knows she'll need more.
But when you're self-employed, it's hard to get into certain retirement funds or to think about it and plan for it.
She's set aside some in a savings account and hides some in a sock, but it hasn't amounted to much. Then the Appalachian Savings Project made an offer. If Wallace saved up $600 in a year in U.S. savings bonds, they'd match half of that.
I thought it was great because it's something that if I don't have a lot of money 1 month to put in, I don't have to worry about it. $25 gets me in the door.
The reality is that more and more people are getting jobs without any benefits, and our public policy hasn't adapted.
Diane Browning runs the savings project for WISER, the Women's Institute for a Secure Retirement. The idea is to take the place of a company retirement plan for those who don't have one. The program uses private money, but it's modeled on a little-known federal tax credit. Browning hopes to show that expanding that credit could help ease a retirement crisis.
We put the match directly into their savings account. So it isn't used for consumption, it's used for long-term investment.
In return, participants last year also had to attend four workshops on financial education, along with how-tos on Social Security and Medicare. It taught women that, research shows, they're prone to put their kids' needs ahead of their own.
Even now, I don't save as much as I could because I still feel like I have to help my kids.
Half an hour away, Juanita McLeod has run a child care center in her basement for three decades. She's 60, but didn't start saving for retirement until after her divorce 7 years ago.
And my youngest son, he still has $30,000 in school loans, and I help him pay those every month. But I guess I'm thinking that maybe, you know, my kids will be there to help me.
McLeod signed on to the savings scheme and says it's motivated her to do more. But overall, the project's been rough going. Women complained they didn't have time to attend financial ed classes, so this year they're voluntary. And even though this tiny program is giving away money, it's been surprisingly hard to find takers. Child care workers say they just have nothing to spare.
we need more people to realize you take care of yourself because nobody else is going to.
Maureen Boggs is with the Corporation for Ohio Appalachian Development, which is recruiting women for the Savings Project. Boggs says she can relate. She was a child care worker for 15 years and didn't save either. But with working class wages stagnant and many living longer than ever, she says the stakes are high.
Look how many people in the stores in our area, how many clerks are at those cash registers that are in their 80s? They're not able to be at home. And they look awfully tired.
To start, Boggs says the amount people set aside is not as important as the habit of doing it. No matter how low their wages, she wants women to realize they can save, and then save more. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
The West Virginia Department of Health and Human Resources says a program intended to keep mothers and their young children healthy has raised its income eligibility guidelines. A family of four can earn $44,123 and still qualify for the Women's Infants and Children Program, commonly known as WIC. This is an increase of $555 in the eligibility ceiling. West Virginia's WIC program serves 70% of all babies born in West Virginia. Families enrolled in the program receive nutrition and breastfeeding education, healthy foods, and access to health care services. The department says the new eligibility guidelines will allow West Virginia to serve more families. Nearly 46,000 mothers and young children are already served monthly. A research center is looking for input from West Virginia farmers and farming families. The new Appalachian Farm and Research Center is examining producers' interest in farm expansion and the feasibility of regional food hubs in the state. Glennis Board explains.
The new Appalachian Farm and Research Center, with the assistance of the environmental consulting firm Downstream Strategies, is conducting a study to assess the feasibility and propose locations for creating regional food hubs in West Virginia. A food hub is a business or organization that actively manages the aggregation, distribution, and marketing of food products sourced locally and regionally for the purpose of satisfying larger buyers, such as schools, grocery, and retail outlets. Organizers believe the absence of regional local food hubs is a major barrier to agricultural growth in West Virginia. The research center is seeking input from West Virginia farmers and farming families about their interests and challenges in expanding their farming operations. With their help, the research center and its partners will be able to collect critical information and guidance to help identify the best locations for these added markets and how to support increased production. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
You can learn more about that project, including a link to a survey, online at wvpublic.org. An Ohio judge is allowing an organic farmer to keep his five-acre property despite the discovery that he was growing hundreds of marijuana plants. Defendant Adam Welly is the co-founder of one of Central Ohio's largest organic farms and the supplier of food to restaurants throughout the region. The Columbus Dispatch reports that Union County Judge Don Frazier ordered the 33-year-old Welly to spend 5 years on probation for growing the marijuana found on the Union County farm last summer. Court records show Welly pleaded guilty earlier this year to marijuana cultivation. Investigators cleared Welly's business partner, who said she had no idea he'd been growing marijuana. Welly's attorney, Michael Probst, said Welly grew the plants to make money at a time he was struggling financially. Kentucky House Speaker Greg Stumbo says lawmakers should be proud of their work in this year's now-finished legislative session. Stumbo says that while some notable bills were ignored right up to the last minute of the session, legislators did a good job on average and passed a new two-year budget.
In about a $12 billion budget, it looks like there might be somewhere around $100 million of new dollars, which is not even going to allow us, quite frankly, to maintain status quo because of just the cost of inflation.
Kentucky lawmakers are required by law to craft and pass a budget every 2 years. Legislation that would have cracked down on the state's growing heroin epidemic failed due to last-minute fighting. A measure to restore voting rights to felons also died this year due to a lack of compromise. the state says a record number of Ohioans died from heroin-related overdoses in 2012 as it released the newest available figures for a problem that's been called an epidemic and public health crisis. The Department of Health says 680 people died of heroin overdoses in 2012, up from 426 deaths in 2011. That's a 60% increase. The state said this week the number of fatal prescription painkiller overdoses decreased for the first time since 2003, a drop attributed to a statewide crackdown on pill mills. Heroin addiction has been increasing as addicts turn to the cheaper and more readily available drug. In Virginia, Governor Terry McAuliffe is making it easier for felons to regain their voting rights. McAuliffe announced this week that he's reducing the waiting period for violent felons to apply for reinstatement from 5 years to 3 years. He's also removing drug offenses from the list of violent crimes that are subject to the waiting period. The changes build on former Governor Bob McDonald's effort to streamline the process. McDonald's administration restored the civil rights of more than 8,000 felons, nearly twice as many as any previous administration. McAuliffe says his administration already has restored the rights of more than 800 Virginians in his first 3 months in office. West Virginia is expanding its tourism funding in hopes of offsetting negative publicity from the January chemical spill in the Elk River that spurred a water use ban for days. Officials this week announced over $1 million cash infusion that will more than double the Division of Tourism's spring advertising campaign budget. The Charleston Gazette reports that the additional funding will allow the ad campaign to expand to new markets and to run more frequently. Commerce Secretary Keith Burdett said the state needs to be proactive in marketing itself and looking at its image. A consumer survey showed there was a high level of awareness of the spill in West Virginia and surrounding states, and some said it would make them less likely to vacation in the state. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Beth Voorhees. The annual West Virginia Pipe Trades Apprentice Contest took place last week in Wheeling. Glennis Board stopped in to see what the competition is all about and brings us this report.
It's a pretty laid-back scene, albeit noisy, but these folks are used to noise. They are the plumber, pipefitters, and HVAC, or heating, venting, and air conditioning workers of today and tomorrow. Eric O'Donnell is the training coordinator from the hosting local 83 Plumbing and Steamfitters in Wheeling.
All apprentices, third year through fifth year, have the opportunity to compete where they put all their skills to the test, see what's your best attributes, what you've picked up the most as you've went along, and they get awarded great prizes.
Prizes include cash, $750 for the tops of each trade, plus gear and equipment, and of course, a chance to compete at the regional and then national events. Kenneth Ralston is this year's top plumbing apprentice. He'll go on to the regional competition in Pittsburgh this June.
This is the test to see if you can't, you are as good as you are expected to be.
So you've been studying as an apprentice for 5 years?
Mm-hmm. Yes, 5 years, and on the job also. I mean, we have school two nights a week and one Saturday a month for the full 5 years, and then we, of course, we do the job as well full-time. So
it's very challenging even still. I mean, I've been practicing for 7 years now, and it's still challenging.
Scott Antonik is a journeyman, which means he made it past the apprentice stage. He's among those helping with the competition this year. He says an opportunity to be paid to learn a practical trade just wasn't something he could pass up.
I wasn't too good in the classroom. I mean, I got very bored sitting in an office-type environment. Worked construction right out of high school and then trying to work myself through college. And then we were taking apprentices in here at Local 83.
Long story short, Antonik applied, and welding really sparked his interest.
I ain't been laid off in 2 years. In the last 2 years, I think I haven't had a job less than 6 days a week and 10 hours a day. Right now, all this gas work we have, which from what we're hearing, it's going to be around here for at least the next decade. And it really helps everybody out, not just pipe fitters. I mean, there's stuff for electricians, for iron workers, truck drivers. I mean, there's everything in this area right now. And it's going to be here for a long time.
The apprentice contest occurs over several days. Apprentices tackle everything from cutting, welding, and bending pipe to knot tying and rigging, which is kind of the art of securing materials like heavy pipes to cranes. There's a cluster of apprentices out in the yard looking onto a scene with a big crane, a large steel box cube-like structure, and between them, a man putting tie straps and chains on a mess of pipes that are all welded together. This is the rigging event. Antonik won this event in years past. He gives me the play-by-play.
We're looking at a pipe module. You got a crane that's got to drop a piece of pipe with all kind of flanges over it down through the steel without touching any of the steel. It kind of simulates a lift in a powerhouse or into a pipe rack where you got obstacles in your way, and you got to be conscious enough to get around those obstacles.
Antonik explains that the competition judges an apprentice's ability to use all the correct hand signals, the proper way to rig the piece of pipe, and also the ability to find a complicated piece of pipe's center of gravity.
He, right now, is trying to get his piece of pipe level and plumb.
Does he look like he's doing a good job?
Yeah, he is doing a good job. Or he needs a let down on that back side, he'll have it perfect. He's pretty close right now. You can see the flanges on the side are plumb straight up and down. The horizontal plane is almost there. That's exactly what you're looking for. A piece like that, it's very hard to find a center of gravity. You can't just pull a tape measure and say, there's my center. You know, you got all kinds of stuff hanging off of it. We got a valve bolted on the other side. The valve's probably 40 pounds. So, I mean, you got to take everything into account. And
How much do you think the whole thing weighs?
That piece, you're probably looking at 600 pounds.
Very important to us that we get the people we need in this state to come forward and do everything they can to get involved, because it's nothing upsets you more than when a contractor comes to our state and asks if we can do the project and they have to actually take it to another state because of the simple fact that we don't have enough hands in our state to do the work. And there is a huge increase in the work right now. It's just unbelievable.
That's Eric O'Donnell again, the training coordinator from Wheeling's Local. When I asked him about job security in the next 10 to 20 years, he says as long as there are people around, plumbing will be around. And he likes that his job is to help secure skilled labor within his own community.
I would like to see myself, the money staying right here, and to see West Virginians employed in West Virginia and making the money and keeping it here and making our communities better.
Again, Scott Antonik, journeyman with Local 83.
We can do this stuff, you know. It's what built West Virginia and Ohio, you know, everything is the people here that can actually do the skilled trades and do it right and have a good life doing it, you know, not doing it for pennies on the dollar, you know. I mean, we're going to make a nice wage, and we're doing some dangerous stuff, and we're doing stuff that's going to help the country out a bunch here. You know, with all this gas that we're getting out, it's really going to help the entire country out.
And as for the 2014 Pipe Trades Apprentice Contest, Kenneth Ralston from Morgantown will be joined by Morgan Morgan and Keith Kidd from Wheeling and Roger Harris from Charleston in the Regional Pipe Trades Apprentice Contest in Pittsburgh this June. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Wheeling.
A Michigan man recently paid a visit to Cabell County in West Virginia to see where his ancestors were once slaves. Clark Davis has the story.
Maurice Sanders is from Michigan, where most of his family lived for the majority of his life. His visit to Marshall's campus and to Huntington last week on the surface is not unlike any other visitor. What makes Sanders' visit special is that much of his family tree in the 1800s was once enslaved in the area that is now Milton in Cabell County. They visited the gravesite of Sampson Sanders, the man who owned Maurice's ancestors.
I just feel really honored just being in the presence of the slave master that owned part of my family.
The story is different, though, than many that have been told about slave owners. Sampson Sanders grew up with many of the slaves he would later inherit. And he wasn't your typical slave owner. He didn't trade or sell slaves. They were a part of a large family. When Sanders died in 1849, according to his will, his slaves were to be set free. So his slaves, along with lawyers that had been hired to travel with the slaves to make sure no one tried to capture them, traveled to Cass County, Michigan to make their home. Maurice Sanders says his interest in the history of his family started as a genealogy study.
I guess I wanted to find as much information as to where they came from as I could with the Allen family, the information that I already had. So that took me back to Sampson Sanders. It took me back through my grandfather, Oscar, into his father, Calvin, into his father, Levi, and back to Sampson Sanders.
Sanders was in rare company in that he was in the top 2.7% of slave owners in the South. At one time, he owned 51 slaves. Sanders, though, never hired anyone to oversee his slaves. Instead, taught them to oversee his property and possessions. Maurice says it's a unique story that he likes to tell.
I'm kind of proud to say that I am a descendant from a former slave. And I've been freed, and we were given free, 40 acres of land. And I think it's a great story that the slave owner, Sampson Sanders, gave them the land and sent an administrator with them to buy the land. So it says a lot more about him as a slave owner.
Maurice says his research was made easier by the family keeping the Sanders name.
Having the Sanders name and having the Sanders name being a slave name, I don't see any problem with it because we had to come from somewhere.
Maurice says it was an emotional trip to see the gravesite of Sampson Sanders.
Being at the gravesite, I found it somewhat emotional, but I reserved some of my emotion because so many people were around. And it was comforting to have some other people with me there. And some people that knew the story probably as well or as much better than I did.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
Here's a story of longing and memories, sweet smells and horrible rank, and also of pathogens and solar pioneer cooking. This is a story about a fading Appalachian tradition that two bakers are working hard to preserve. Once again, here's reporter Glennis Board.
Salt rising bread is an Appalachian traditional bread made without yeast. It's a baking custom that can be traced back to the 1800s, but not much has been documented about the bread or its history. So two women in Mount Morris, Pennsylvania, began a quest to understand the hows and whys behind a tradition that seems to captivate anyone who catches wind of it. Bakers Jenny Bardwell and Susan Brown have been researching the bread for 20 years.
We often describe salt rising bread as dense white bread with a fine crumb and a unique cheese-like flavor. Indeed, it is, when at its best, as if a delicately reared, unsweetened plain cake had had an affair with a Pont-l'Evêque cheese.
Susan Brown quotes James Furness, who describes salt rising bread in his book, The Americans.
So in other words, fancy combination of a fancy French cheese and a plain sweet cake, and you get that sweet cheese-like savory flavor of salt rising bread.
Brown grew up in Greenbrier County, where every Saturday she would have salt rising toast and eggs for breakfast with her grandmother. She's passionate about passing down the tradition. Brown's friend, Jenny Bardwell, was introduced to the custom through a neighbor, the recently deceased Pearl Haynes of Mount Morris, who made the bread for 90 years.
I'd go visit her, and they were making this bread that I'd never heard of, and it was a very unique bread. There's no yeast in it. So I immediately latched on to, this is special. Mm-hmm. I'd never learned about anything like that in cooking school.
Bardwell is the owner of Rising Creek Bakery in Mount Morris. She and Brown opened the bakery about 5 years ago, and now it's one of the only places in the country that produces the product. Hundreds of loaves are shipped out each week. Through surveying their customers, Bardwell and Brown have discovered that by far, the favorite way to eat the bread is toasted with butter. Others like it dipped in sweet coffee or toasted with milk and brown sugar on top. The history of salt rising bread is something of a mystery. Passed down as an oral tradition, there are few records that hint at its origin. Brown and Bardwell have done some serious research, though. They've even traveled to bakeries abroad looking for connections. While it's difficult to draw any definite conclusions, their best guess is that the tradition was born of necessity in remote and isolated Appalachian regions in the late 1700s. Bardwell says the bread is a testament to the spirit of the female pioneer.
What we're finding out really is the ingenuity of pioneer women and how they persevered with their cooking. They weren't able to get commercial yeast. It wasn't even produced till the 1860s, but they wanted a loaf of bread, so they kind of, anyway, they persevered with this very difficult bread to make.
We also believe that it's possible that these pioneer women would leave flour and water mixed together, like from maybe a gravy or the cream sauce that they were putting on something, and realized that if it was set overnight, it would bubble in the morning and their bread would rise from that.
Even the name, Salt Rising Bread, is a little mysterious. Brown says it's really a misnomer because recipes call for very little salt. She says one possible explanation might have something to do with a wagon wheel.
We do have documentation of the pioneer women who crossed the country on the pioneer trails keeping their starters warm in the salt barrel, which was kept on top of the wagon wheel. And as they traveled across the country during the day, the sun would warm the salt, which would in turn warm the starter.
Wow.
And then they could make their bread in the evening when they stopped traveling.
Bardwell explains that heat is a critical ingredient in dough making.
It's a very difficult bread to make. Primarily, the main difference between salt rising bread and sourdough, which is wild yeast, salt rising bread is primarily wild bacteria that you're culturing with heat. Sourdough happens at room temperature. Salt rising bread happens from about 105 to 115 degrees Fahrenheit.
Bardwell says there are three phases of salt rising bread. You got to make a starter dough, then grow it, then bake it. Simple, right?
And it's variable since you're capturing wild bacteria. Sometimes it's 9 hours, sometimes it's 11 hours. And you have to be really tuned into this bread. You have to kind of know how to recognize it when it's ready. Not before, not an hour later. You have to kind of know. Then you make it into a sponge stage, so you're kind of increasing this batch of microbes.
Bardwell says depending on which recipe you use, the starters look very different.
One's with milk, one's with potatoes and water. They look very different, but and they smell differently. That is another big characteristic of salt rising bread is it smells strong. I kind of like the smell. Some people can't stand it.
Bardwell says she met one centenarian from North Central West Virginia who remembers that smell from her childhood. The old woman said she knew to avoid the neighbors when she could smell the dough because the missus only made it when she was really angry with her husband, who hated the smell. So what makes it stink is what makes it rise. This is where the baker meets the candlestick maker. Brown and Bardwell put their science caps on and headed to a lab in Pittsburgh.
In just our own quest to find out what is this microbe that's rising the bread that lends this wonderful flavor, we had it isolated, and we took like a dozen starters up to this scientist in University of Pittsburgh. He was very nice to entertain us with this whole quest. And we walk in and it smells just like salt rising bread.
So this guy, Bruce McLean, has made a name for himself as a pathologist, and he studies Clostridium perfringens, one of the wild microbes responsible for the rising in the salt rising bread. The women explain that they came to learn that these microbes can be pathogenic. They can cause, get ready for it, gangrene in human beings, or enteritis. That's diarrhea. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nobody's gotten sick from eating salt rising bread. As a matter of fact, we've written an article with a physician at WVU, Dr. Greg Juckett, he who loves salt rising bread. And there is absolutely no history of anyone ever getting sick eating salt rising bread.
Bardwell, Brown, and McLean helped write an article with Dr. Greg Juckett for the West Virginia Medical Journal to highlight how salt rising bread has absolutely no history of causing any disease or discomfort.
Bacteria exchange DNA all the time. Their DNA is moving around. And for some reason, with salt rising bread, that plasmid, that toxin, DNA, it exits. Nobody really understands why.
Remember when I mentioned that Brown and Bardwell have gone so far as to visit bakeries abroad looking for the origin of salt rising bread? Well, they didn't find it. But they did find a couple of very similar yeastless breads. In Greece, there's a recipe that calls for chickpeas. In the Sudan, there's a recipe that uses lentils.
And we found that there are these scientific studies in Turkey and Greece and Sudan on these similar breads, and they've studied them extensively. They say have the same results. There's no pathogenic toxin to be found.
Brown explains that it turns out Clostridium perfringens and some other bacteria are ubiquitous. They're found all through nature, on the potatoes, in the flour, in the cornmeal. Somehow, Bardwell suspects a symbiotic relationship between all of these bacteria raise the bread and give it flavor and texture. But the fact that it doesn't make anyone sick is still kind of a mystery.
another mystery. By the by, Bardwell and Brown really want to find someone who is interested in researching the bread and the wild microbes. They say they're willing participants. Their quest to understand this bread continues, even as the tradition seems to be facing extinction. Brown says there are a couple of reasons it's fallen from fashion. She says the elder keepers of the oral tradition are dying, along with their way of life.
Salt rising bread requires that you are home all day. You literally cannot leave your house because you have to be so careful to watch each stage and be there when it's ready.
But for now, Bardwell and Brown, and at least a few others throughout Appalachia, are still nurturing the wild microbial bread.
One of the goals that we had when we started this bakery was we want to make salt rising bread and send it to the people who have not had it for years, but who pine for it and who really have cherished beautiful, loving memories of it. And we have accomplished that, and that feels wonderful.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Mount Morris. And I'll leave you with one of the stories that Brown and Bardwell have collected from their salt rising bread customers.
I grew up in Spelter, West Virginia, just north of Clarksburg on Route 19, where the zinc factory used to be. My grandmother baked this bread every Saturday morning of her life. I don't think she ever bought bread. She would make several loaves and a couple of cookie sheets full of wonderful large buns. We lived next door, and she would call me over just before she took the bread out of the oven. I would race over and wait, usually impatiently, until the bread came out. Then I would take one of those buns and poke my finger into the middle and wiggle it around to hollow it out a bit. I would then put fresh, real butter and my daddy's homemade blackberry jelly down into that hot bread. It would melt, and I would sit and eat that bun with a glass of cold milk. I'm 50 years old, and my granny has been gone for nearly 40 years. If I close my eyes and let myself go back in time, I can still smell that wonderful aroma as the bread was baking and still feel my finger burning from sticking it into the bread, and I can almost taste that wonderful treat. It's one of my most cherished memories of my grandmother, who was my favorite person in the world.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Mount Morris.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Beth Voorhees. Spring has essayist Sarah Lowther Hensley thinking about renewal, change, and the future with a little dash of fond memories.
It's spring, and along with bunches of daffodils, robins, and ramp festivals, there's a feeling in the air of fresh starts and new beginnings. After the winter we've had, all I can say is hallelujah. Ironically, though, it was a hint of autumn that made me think of new life this week. As I drove by our elementary school, I noticed the sign in front heralding that the next day was kindergarten registration day. We're just about a year away from high school orientation, but boy, do I remember that earlier rite of passage. It's been several years, but it seems like yesterday that we walked through the doors of that very school with our son to get him signed up for kindergarten. Registering your child for kindergarten. Do we have all the right paperwork? Our son has a July birthday, so he's one of the youngest in his class. Should we have him start kindergarten this year or wait a year? When school starts in the fall, will he like his teacher? Will we like his teacher? That day of kindergarten registration had "This is a big milestone in our son's life and ours" written all over it. And truth be told, it was a milestone. We reached it. We passed it by. And we've kept on traveling through all the years of elementary school and into middle school past more milestones. Each milestone brought its own questions and anxieties, and excitement and opportunities. We reached them together and with plenty of supportive family and friends to cheer us along the way. Life's like that. Each new opportunity holds its own questions and its own excitement and anticipation. But like the fresh, crisp, blank sheets of paper in your backpack on that first day of school, each opportunity holds out the promise of a fresh start and unknown adventures, all just around the next bend. So I welcome spring and its traditional signs of new, forsythia and redbud and baseball. But I'm saving some good thoughts for those parents and kids turning their cars into the grade school parking lots over the next few weeks, walking hand in hand into the building and signing up for great adventures. The world awaits. Go get 'em.
Sarah Lowther Hensley lives in Fairmont, West Virginia. She's a writer, former public radio journalist, and higher education administrator. She provides a volunteer communication support to the Mon Valley District of the United Methodist Church and writes for her blog at homeamongthehills.wordpress.com. When spring arrives, many of us can't wait to plant that summer garden. Some gardeners like starting seeds themselves, but at $2 to $3 per packet, the cost of trying different seeds adds up. Seed sharing makes starting seeds more affordable, and it's a great way to get some variety into the garden. Here's this report.
Mary Beth Tacker has been doing it for about 7 years, but she's still not sure exactly what to call it. Some say it's a seed share or a seed exchange, but Tacker tells the 20 people gathered at the Moon Township Library this Saturday morning that none of those labels is quite right.
People automatically think it's some kind of a swap thing, where you have to bring some seeds and we exchange them. But that's not the case here. It's all new seeds.
Tekar starts looking at seed catalogs around Christmas time and orders a huge variety. 4 types of tomatoes, 4 kinds of lettuce, 2 different cucumbers, and many more.
I mean, keep in mind that when you buy, for instance, lettuce seeds and you get 500 seeds in there, do you need 500 seeds? I don't think so. I think we can share those and you'll have sufficient.
Everyone sits around a long rectangular table. Each person gets a seed packet with a corresponding series of labels and a stack of 20 small cups. The label tells them how many seeds go in each cup, and they start counting. It's easy for big seeds like the Sibley winter squash. Each cup gets only 2 or 3 seeds. But those teeny dust-like seeds, forget about it.
But these are tiny. What are these?
These ones are parsley. They're so small you don't really count them. You just make sure it looks about the same.
Alexander Dale is a young engineer whose work is focused on sustainability. He was among those asking questions and throwing around gardening tips.
I mean, I grew up with gardening. You know, I think most of our vegetables for the latter half of the summer were always from our own garden.
Dale moved to the city, and it's been a few years since he's had his hands in the dirt.
Because I was in college for a long time and moving all the time and didn't have a yard. So now I've been in a house where we have a backyard, and we've been there for a few years, and now I can actually get back to growing my own food.
Once Dale finishes divvying the parsley seeds, he pours the contents of each cup into a very small manila envelope. He seals it and sticks a label to it. Some gardeners, like Mary Gregg, have come back to the seed divvy year after year so they can keep trying new things.
Last year we got purple cherry tomato seeds here. And actually, I didn't realize they were going to be purple. And then when they were growing and they start ripening and they're like kind of this strange color, you were like, but they were really good. They were some of the best cherry tomatoes I've ever had. So,
at the other end of the table, Michelle Dunn is finishing up her seed sorting.
Your garden.
No, this is all new to me. I'm not even familiar with half of this, so I didn't realize there's, you know, so many types of tomatoes or lettuce. It's very exciting.
So this is helping you get into gardening?
Yes, absolutely. I just bought a house and has a big, huge garden in the backyard that was abandoned by the previous owner, so I'm going to just go in and see what I can do.
Organizer Mary Beth Tekar says she started the seed divvy years ago when she was working on a public garden and they had extra seeds to share.
But now, the reason I'm interested and involved is because I am, you might say, discouraged about the plight of the world and what could I do to make a positive difference in the world. And I felt that encouraging people to grow their own vegetables, get healthy and all that, was a very positive thing to do that I could feel very good about. And plus, everybody that's involved with me can feel really good about it, too.
Once the envelopes are filled and labeled, they take them to the back of the room where there's a brown lunch bag with each person's name on it. They drop 1 seed envelope in each bag. Everyone's been doing this and then taking new seed packets and divvying up more. By the end, the bags are filled with seed envelopes.
We're excited about our seed share.
A couple of hours on a Saturday morning, and folks are ready for the warm weather so they can head outside and get their hands in the dirt. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The Kentucky House and Senate aren't always restricted to partisan disagreements, resolutions, or passage of legislation. As WEKU's Stu Johnson reports, the last day of the 2014 General Assembly also included some impromptu singing.
They gathered around a senator's desk just before going into session. Five lawmakers of both political parties and a page offered up this song during Holy Week. Just moments after the rendition of Amazing Grace, Frankfurt pastor Gary Hager noted the singing during the opening prayer for the 60th day of the legislative session. Lawrenceburg teenager Bethany Fugel was a Senate page. She says she's been singing publicly for about 6 years and never had a vocal lesson. Her mother, Annette Fugel, sat at a welcoming table down the hall from the Senate.
We are a musical family. The oldest kids did classical piano. We lived in the West. When we moved to Kentucky, we did a total switch and went to bluegrass. So we have kids that learn the mandolin and the banjo, and I have an upright bass, and Beth plays the guitar. So we made a change. So the second half of our family does this kind of stuff.
Yes, Jesus loves me. The Bible tells me so.
For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Beth Voorhees. WVGhosts.com is an archive of West Virginia ghost stories, and they're looking for more submissions. Glennis Ford has more.
Jonathan Moore of PAX West Virginia started collecting West Virginia ghost stories 15 years ago because, well, he kept hearing them.
Neighbors would just be telling me about their stories and stories within PAX, and so I decided to take those stories and then gather more stories from other people around West Virginia in order to develop an archive for West Virginia for other people to read and share their own experiences.
So that's what he did. His mission is to provide unedited, untampered with proof of the paranormal. WestVirginiaGhosts.com has amassed over 450 stories. And now, in addition to submitting stories through Facebook and Twitter, Moore is announcing a new way to share spooky experiences, a ghost call-in line.
So people can call in and just, they can tell their stories on recording and then have it transcribed into text, which with the hotline, they can also text their story to us or even send a picture through it.
Moore says while the website continues to be popular, he's seen decreases in submissions over the years. He wants to reach more people because, he says, at least one in five people he bumps into has a great story to tell. He's hoping the new call-in line will boost submissions. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glennis Ford in Morgantown.
April is celebrating Poetry Month across the nation. West Virginia has had a great many poets find success, including Irene McKinney, Linda Goodman, and Tom Andrews. But there's a young man from Fairmont who's now also making a name for himself in the field of poetry. Beneduccio has more.
Ian Williams is a 21-year-old college student at Fairmont State University. He studies English education, and he dreams of becoming a college professor at some point during his life. But before that, he's finding success as a poet. Williams recently won a National Poetry Award in the National Federation of State Poetry Society's College University Level Poetry Competition. Ian was one of two first place winners nationwide. He says he first got interested in poetry as a high school student in Fairmont.
In high school, I was that kid who thought he was like super sensitive and was really pretentious about being able to feel. I can feel the pains of the world and I can capture them and write them down. And clearly not a high school kid in Fairmont. Don't know anything about the world.
William stopped writing for a while in high school and early on in college, but he picked up poetry again during his second year at Fairmont State. He says he worked with a professor who helped him better shape his work. Now he's a teacher too. He is completing his student teaching at North Marion High School in Marion County. He says writing poetry is like going on an adventure, and he hopes to convince young people that the adventure is worth taking.
I think that poetry has been largely overlooked by a lot of people because it's short and it's compact and there's a lot of meaning into it. And I think a lot of times it's kind of gained this very pretentious reputation, and I'm hoping that in some small way I can help to break down that reputation and to kind of make poetry accessible for a broader selection of people.
Williams's winning selection is a manuscript entitled House of Bones. While tapping his feet gently and using his hands to speak the words, Williams reads one of his poems.
This is one of the poems from my collection, House of Bones, that I got this award for. It's called Work Ethics, and it's kind of talking about the how work has changed over the course of time, especially from a masculine perspective, as we try to justify the work we do now compared to the work we've done before. So as I said, it's called Work Ethics, and I'll read it. A change of pace, the transition from breathing stale air to swallowing the thin chill of winter, whistling through the weeping willows, sifting faded Polaroids, aging orange and indigo faces, fathers and fathers before, wearing the cartilage away in cornfields, coal mines, as their sons try justifying, holding down desks, crunching accounts, mothers' arthritic fingers stilled, mending worn denim, thread stretched up, gaze diligent, pulling the weight of family, like the needle past canvas, calloused knuckles, churn the Iowan crust as younger joints adjust vectors and pick Pantone's watches. Constructing drywalled offices, three stories above, earth turned by grandfathers, pacing the foundations they poured, we wonder whether we have one of our own.
He says writing a poem can present a great deal of struggle, including being happy with the words you've put on paper.
I think that's one of the biggest struggles with writing, perhaps poetry in particular, I don't know, but that kind of self-criticism and self-editing that goes on, and you're never quite ready with something. I think it was, oh gosh, who was it? I can't remember whether it was Walt Whitman. I think it was Walt Whitman, who would constantly edit his work. He'd put out an edition, he'd publish it, and then he'd come back and redo a whole poem and come back and publish it again in a different edition. So it's the constant editing that goes on, and I don't think it's ever going to go away. I'm not sure I even wanted to, but it's, I don't think you can really come across the perfect poem at all. It's something you just keep doing, can keep doing.
But what does it take to be a good poet?
I think the qualities that you really have to be a good poet are, one, you have to have the determination to do it, and you have to have the determination to study and do your reading and look at it and study it seriously. And secondly, I think you have to be open-minded enough to take criticism and and allow other people to butcher your work, because you can't get too attached to it, because very frequently I have written something and I've given it to other people to look at and they've just torn it apart. And while that's been kind of devastating when you've put hours into a poem or something like that, it really helps. And you have to build the tough skin and realize that it's part of the process. The poetry isn't a one-shot deal. It's a constant set of writing and revision and then workshopping and then revision and then workshopping and revision over and over and over again.
Williams will be receiving the Florence Kahn Memorial Award for his win in this competition. That includes $500 in cash, and his manuscript will be published as a chapbook, a small publication including 10 of his poems, which will be limited to just 100 copies. He will also be reading from the book in Salt Lake City in June to celebrate the victory.
I've never really done a public presentation, although that's going to come up when the celebration for this chapbook shows up in Salt Lake City. So how I'm going to present that and perform poetry at that reading, I have absolutely no idea. And it's a completely new world for me. This award has opened up so many opportunities. It's unreal.
Williams may have to get used to it. He's already working on new poems and on a new book of poetry about art. He hopes it to be released this year. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beneduccio in Fairmont.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WYEP in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, NPR, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Pettaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. I'm Beth Voorhees, sitting in this week for Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.